This week's episode of It's Easy Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And today I'm excited. I have one of the young guns with me today in the HBCU world, a young man that I literally a young man. When he tells his story, you're going to be surprised. But I'm so pleased that our paths cross in a very interesting way. We both attended the Harvard Summer Institute, I'll call it. In 2015, and I just knew then he was destined for greatness and just didn't see it happening this quickly. But ladies and gentlemen, today I have with me the president of the Edward Waters College.
Yes.
My good
yes.
friend, Mr. A. Zachary Faison, Jr., a young man. I'm going to keep using the phrase young man. He is a young man doing some awesome things. My folks in my church would say he's a old man in a young body.
And there we go. We'll take that.
He's delivering. He's delivering every day. Dr. Faison, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Wonderful. It's great to see you again, my brother. It's been too long. Been too long. But it's been great, great, great. I have an opportunity to see you, and it's great being with you today.
All right. Great. So what we do is on this podcast is we try to get the audience to learn about our guests and, quite frankly, to inspire. And as a college president, you do that every day. But what we want to do is to learn a little bit about your story, your early years coming up, even all the way down to grade school, all the way up. Great. I don't ask a lot of questions. What I do is ask open-ended questions. And based on your responses, from there, we'll come away with more questions. And before you know it, this hour is over. So with that, let's just jump right in. You know, who is Zachary Faison Jr.? What grounds him? What is it? What's at his core, and what drives him even to this day?
Well, A. Zachary Faison Jr. is the son of Alderman Faison Sr. and Dr. Jewel Faison. I'm a native son of Atlanta, Georgia, so I'm a native of the South. Was born and raised in Atlanta. My mother is a lifelong educator. I think that was a mantle that obviously I have taken on that I didn't know and didn't have any plans to take that on. But my mother's a lifelong educator. My father is a computer programmer. And I will say that what grounds me, I came up in a very, I won't say religious. Religious is not the right word. Sometimes it has such a negative connotation. Now you hear religious or religiosity. But a very, very faith-infused home. Mm-hmm. You know, it was it was one of those kinds of homes where literally, I think back on it now, and literally I think I was doing something involved with the church probably about four times a week as a youngster. It was, you know, I mean, I can think on, we had service on Sunday morning and Sunday night. Then there was a Tuesday mid-morning, if you can believe it or not, service that sometimes I would tag along with my parents too. Then there was the Wednesday night service. Then there was Thursday. There was a choir practice. and then on the weekends, on Friday and Saturday, they would have community groups amongst parishioners. And so either on Friday or Saturday, we were doing something with the church, and then it would start all over again. So I'm a very strong faith-based upbringing. I am the brother of Dr. Morgan Zakiya Jewel Faison, who is also an educator. She's an assistant professor at the University of Georgia in their College of Education. Oh. And so both of my parents, I'm a third generation graduate of an HBCU. Both of my parents are HBCU graduates. My mother attended Spelman College there in Atlanta. She's a native Atlantan as well. And my father is from a little town called Clinton, North Carolina. It's about 45 minutes to an hour outside of Fayetteville. And he's a graduate of North Carolina A&T State University. Go Aggies. I think both of my, and then on my mother's side, my grandmother, and it was such a God will thing that I would have an opportunity to head an AME, an African Methodist Episcopal institution here at EWC. But my grandmother was a graduate of Morris Brown College in Atlanta. And again, just came full circle. Never thought that I would have an opportunity to head an AME school, which Morris Brown, of course, is an African Methodist Episcopal institution. So growing up, education was everything in my household. I mean, it literally, having a mother that's an educator. So she was an elementary school teacher, a middle school teacher, then became a principal. And was fortunate to, kind of go up the ranks and eventually became an assistant superintendent and then a county superintendent in Georgia. So when you're with your mother, most of the time my father was working, but I would say my childhood was largely shaped by my mom. And kind of going, being there in her classrooms. And of course, when you have a mother as an educator, she's teaching you things even before you even start grade school. And so I think that my faith and I think growing up with an educator in my home and being the child of two college graduates and a third generation graduate of a HBCU, education really shaped, my formative years in many ways.
Yeah. So, it's always that interaction with faith and education. And all of the guests that I've had who have had parents as educators, it was almost a mantle was placed on them. And you're saying it comes full circle for you. But what was elementary school like, coming from that home?
Yeah.
The expectation there, as most African-American or Black families will have, you're going to do well. Was that already placed on you and your sister coming up?
Absolutely. I mean, there was, I kind of was drilled, a mantra was drilled into me that you are going to be excellent. There are no excuses for you not to be excellent. That's just what it was. I give you this example, and I'll talk about elementary school because interestingly enough, both my mother and my sister, most of their research, my mother went to Spelman and then she went to Emory for a master's degree, a PhD at Emory as well there in Atlanta. And her research was around the mentoring of African-American students in predominantly white institutions. My sister came along, 25 years later, and she's a graduate of Spelman, and then went to Penn for her master's and then went to Emory for her PhD. And much of her research is around, particularly around students of color in K-12 settings, and particularly as it relates to Black boys. And so I'm going somewhere with this. So when I was in elementary school, very bright, precocious Black boy, and my mom, this is the mid-80s, was always wanting to find the right space for her young, very energetic, always has a lot to say, free-spirited Black boy. I started out in a Christian school, a Christian private school, as a kindergarten and even K-4. They even still do that K-4, K-5 as start kindergarten and that kind of thing. And then I ended up in second grade at the local public school. And so I was there for a while, and I was in first grade, excuse me. And I ended up getting skipped all the way to third grade. And wow. this is in public school. And I had somewhat of a traumatic experience because, since I had skipped two grades, I was encountering some, and there weren't really difficulties because I was two grades outside of where I was aged to be, but I had some difficulty in some math or something like that. And I had a teacher there that, and I can recall it even now that, when everyone else was at recess, I had to stay in because I had gotten some math problems wrong or what have you. But unbeknownst to me, I'm in a third grade class and I'm in the first grade. But it was, wow, what's going on? And so it was kind of a devastating experience for me. And my mom, again, being an educator, she said, well, I don't want my child damaged. I don't want him to think that, there's something wrong with him, because I couldn't contextualize again that I was, in two grades ahead.
Right.
And so then, you know, and here's you'll see there's a kind of consistent theme that will emerge. My mom moved me out of that school and I went to a private school in Atlanta called Paideia. It's a, you know, rich kind of, you know, snooty, not in a bad way, but it's, you know, overwhelmingly for those that are, you know, well-to-do, that have a whole lot of money. My parents didn't, but they sacrificed. I mean, we had a teacher and a computer programmer. They sacrificed tremendously to send me to this, you know, very, very expensive, overwhelmingly white private school there in Atlanta. And so I went to school there from second through fourth grade. So that's, I spent the next 3 years there. And it was a different experience. And again, you'll see this consistent theme kind of emerge, because I was not the tip. Well, I think I was the typical young Black male child. Yeah. And this is in the mid 80s. Where, you know, they want you to sit in the desk and kind of, that wasn't me. Like, I wasn't sitting in no desk. Like, you know, extremely bright, smart. Hey, no issues with the work, but I'm not, you know, that's not who I am now. Like, I want to talk. I want to interact. I want to ask questions. You say, well, this is, you know, blue. And I'm like, well, why is it blue? That doesn't look blue to me. Explain to me why. And so, you know, most of my teachers were like, hey, what do I do with this kid? I mean, like, you know, they say, well, it's time to do language arts. Well, I don't want to do language arts right now. I want to do biology. You know, and so, as my mom would say, rebellion. You know, some of it was just, again, I've always kind of wanted to do things my own way. But the interesting thing about that is that often our kids, and I thank God for having a mother that was an educator, a mother that was a Black educator, because often, had I not had that, you see kids like that put in tracks and programs that speak to their capacity for learning, when it really is, no, you got an issue with their behavioral, whatever it is. Right. Again, this is the same. I'm the same kid that was skipped two grades.
Right.
But you know, that they'll put you in the corner, or he's a behavioral this or that. And my mom never allowed that to be my reality. You know, and so I thank God that I had that, because again, you know, I wasn't like the other little white kids, you know, and so, you know, I could have been very easily trapped into something that, you know, would not have been positive for my development. But thank God I had parents, a mom and a dad, that were like, nah, I just got to get in there and tell him sit his behind down. You know, I mean, like, I needed that kind of, you know, interaction when, you know, most of my teachers that were, you know, I'll just say it, they were white teachers that, you know, may have been Ivy League trained, but they didn't know how to deal with this little Black boy. That, yeah. You know what I mean? You know, you tell me go to timeout. I'm like, timeout? What is that? You know, I'm like, timeout? No, that didn't work for me. I'm just my mom saying, look, I'm going to get in your behind if you don't do X, Y, and Z. So that was elementary school for me.
Yeah, so let me ask you this, because I see you talk about common themes, but I'm seeing a common theme all the way now through your energy as a president.
Right.
It looks like it hasn't changed much, but did that same energy carry you through high school, into college, anything? So obviously you're a bright person, because you wouldn't be where you are today, the degrees and all the things that you've accomplished so quickly. But was that a Zachary Faison throughout, even up until today? High school was the same all the way through?
I would say so. I think that people that would describe me through, you know, middle school and high school and college, I've always been just high energy, a lot to say, very opinionated, but you know, someone that wanted to achieve. Again, that was my household. I'll tell this quick story. I was in the eighth grade, and like most, you know, young Black, you know, urban kids, I fashioned myself an athlete at one time, and I had these big dreams. I'm going to the NBA. Basketball was my sport. I mean, I just love basketball. I was in the eighth grade, the middle school coach came to my dad. I was like, listen, your son, really, I don't know if you know this or not, and I'm not saying this. My students, if they see this, they'll be like, this is a complete lie. No, ask my dad. So coach came to my dad and said, listen, your son is extremely talented. Like, he really has a future in basketball. You know, why is he not on the team? You know, why, you know, we need your son on this team. Like, your son can play. And my dad said he made a C in algebra. He's not playing anything. Oh, wow. Ever. We don't make C's in my household. B's much less. But he made a C in algebra. He won't see a ball until whenever. Okay. Wow. I mean, that was my household. Like, a C? You brought a C into my home? Are you out of your mind? you'll be basketballing with this algebra until the foreseeable future. Oh, wow. So that was the nature of, you know, my upbringing. And my parents always said, you know, throughout high school or what have you, especially when I was in high school, it was, Zachary, you just kind of get by on your own intellect. You don't ever put in the work.
Wow.
That's necessary. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my story until I went to college, is that, you know, my parents always said, yeah, okay, Zachary, you may be naturally gifted, but we see that you're not getting the most out of, you know, your giftings, you know. But I was like, hey, what, you know, but I'm winning this award, I'm doing this, you know, I'm X, Y, and Z. But my parents knew, but yeah, but you don't have any study habits. You don't apply yourself, you know. And so my parents were always very, very intentional around me getting the best out of what God had given me and ensuring in me and giving me the principles of hard work, not just getting by, even though you can, quote unquote, get by. We're not going to let you get by because we know that you can do even better. So that was definitely who I was, I think, through high school.
So by the time you got into college, I think you were pretty much on your way. Having a background and a family behind you, parents like that, you pretty much knew that it's time to get it done.
I tell people this, you know, you know, it's a product of, again, being from a family of educators and having parents that went to college and a grandparent that went to college. For me, it was never, are you going to college? It was what college you were going to. I mean, that was, as you know, from elementary school, that was never a question. But the interesting thing was, when I came through high school, I went to a communications magnet school. And I know you'll remember there was a guy that was extremely popular that was on ESPN, the sports show. Like I said, so coming up, sports was my thing. I mean, right. I love sports. And so, by that time, I figured I wasn't going to go to the NBA, you know, once I, you know, left, you know, was leaving high school. But I knew that I still felt like I wanted to do something that was related to sports. And so there was a guy on ESPN that you'll recall named Stuart Scott.
Yeah.
And he was kind of like my idol. I said, man, if I could get an opportunity to be a sports broadcast journalist, that would, you know, I could still be, you know, in the sports arena and sports realm even though I wouldn't be, you know, a professional athlete. So, you know, in high school, I was at a communications magnet school, wrote for the paper. They had a broadcast journalism program and was really involved in that and worked at CNN and TBS and all that, you know, while I was in Atlanta. So had some opportunities to internship there. So anyway, long story short, for college, I wanted to go to a heavy communication school. So I looked at Syracuse. Syracuse was, you know, it still is, has a great communications program. I also looked at American University, which is in Washington, D.C. They had a great communications program. And so I applied and got into both of them, but chose that I said I was going to go to American University. Got in and they did not. I think the tuition at that time was about $35,000, something like that. I'm sure it's much more than that even now. But at that time, this is 1998. It was about 30 grand. And so I got in and they gave me maybe like $7,000 or $8,000. And so my parents were not going to allow me to take out any loans. I thank God that they were smart enough even then to say, no, you're not taking out loans. You don't want to be saddled with that. I was gung-ho that I was going to go to American University. So I was wanting my parents to fill in the difference. It was about another $22,000 or what have you. My parents told me no.
Oh, wow.
They told me no. They said, we told you while you were in high school and through, you know, elementary school, middle school, I went to these, you know, really elite private schools that literally the tuitions there were like college. I mean, it was IDEA and the children's school and these other schools. Like, it literally is like $20,000 a year. They're like, we spent your college, we spent your college money preparing you, and we told you that you were going to have to get a scholarship to go to school. Okay. And you chose to get by with these, you know, you're making all these B's and you should have been making A's, you know, but I'm thinking, you know, in comparison to my peers, I'm a good student, you know, but I was not a great student, which is what my parents were requiring. Yeah. I made 1,000+ on the SAT. I'm one of the only Black males in my school. But that's not, my parents were like, but that's not the measure. The measure is not what you see here in, at your school. The measure is you're competing globally, and you didn't do what was necessary for you to get a full scholarship. So you're gonna go where you can get a full scholarship. I was crushed. I was crushed. I mean, my dream was to go to American University in Washington, D.C. I did enough to get in, so why can't I go?
Yeah.
So, you know, interestingly enough, an HBCU was not my first choice.
Wow.
I thank God it was absolutely where I needed to be, but I didn't think that at the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the next story was I was going to Morehouse College. So my which of course you're very familiar with Morehouse, having just come from there. I was going to Morehouse. Again, you know, my mom's a Spelman grad, all my aunts are Spelman graduates. My grandmother, the graduate at Morris Brown, had worked at Morehouse for 20 years in the registrar's office. And at this time, though, she was working in the Woodruff Library. She was the circulation librarian. So she spent over 40 years in the AU Center. So I was going to Morehouse, right? And so, Morehouse was only offering me a partial amount of money. And my parents were very consistent. You're going wherever they will give you all the money. We're not paying anything for you to go to college. We told you what you were supposed to do. And so... So I said, okay, I'm going to go to Morehouse. I got a partial scholarship there, and I had an opportunity to have a full scholarship, but it was going to be in the form of the Navy ROTC program.
Yep.
Right? Uh-huh. Through Morehouse, which has an excellent program. I mean, I'm like, the Navy? Like, y'all want me to go to the I want to be Stuart Scott. I'm going to communications. Uh-huh. And so also this is heavy math. This is heavy, you know, physics, you know? So I remember my mom took me over to the Navy ROTC. I don't know. I may be using the wrong terminology. Lieutenant or whomever it is. He was the head guy there at the Navy ROTC. And so yeah, he sits down with me. I mean, super, you know, military, you know, young man, great to meet you. You know, he's doing the whole, I mean, and so, you know, I say to him, well, you know, I really want to be in broadcast journalism and I'm willing to do internships. And he's like, no, sir, we'll be, you know, training you to be a soldier. You'll be spending the summers, you know, on these aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
I'm like, nah, this ain't happening, Mom. You know what I'm saying? And I remember my mom and my dear aunt. My aunt had an older aunt that was really, really influential in my life. They were like, listen, this is what you'll go to Morehouse. You won't owe any debt. You come out as a naval officer in the military. That is prestigious. I mean, you won't owe any dollars. You'll go right into it. I said, yeah, but I'm not going to war. Again, as ignorant as that may sound, in my mind, I'm 18. I'm not going to the military. Like, that's not for the kid, right?
Yeah.
But they're like, hey, that's what you got. So then I was like, well, I had a little job at Foot Locker. I was like, look, I'll just stay at home and I'll work at Foot Locker. Again, this 18-year-old. Yep. They're like, no, you won't be doing that. You're going to go into the Navy. And I'm like, nah, that's not going to work. And so my mom was like, well, I don't care what you do. But you're going to the Navy for all I care. You can come down and go to Albany State. So that this time my mom was assistant superintendent of schools in Daugherty County, Georgia, in Albany. Even though we were still living in Atlanta, she was going back and forth on the weekends, that kind of thing. I never stepped foot on Albany State's campus. Albany State was never discussed in my household.
Right.
She just mentioned that on a whim, was like, I don't care if you go to, if you got to come to Albany State, you're going where they can give you the money. So I never even applied to Albany State.
Wow.
My mother filled out the application at Albany State because I'm like, look, I'm just going to stay in Atlanta and I don't know what I was just being stupid.
Yeah.
Well, work at Foot Locker and whatever. Yeah. So my mom filled out the application for me to go to Albany State, sit in all of my transcripts and everything. And at Albany State, I was accepted because, like I said, I wasn't I was a good student, but I didn't fulfill what my parents felt and what I can say now was my full potential. But I was still good enough to get a full presidential scholarship at Albany State.
Yeah,
Albany State is a little different from Morehouse, a little different from American University. You know, so I was able to get a full scholarship there, and my parents said, "You're going to Albany State." I was crushed. I had these dreams. I went to go to D.C. and all of that, and now you're sending me to Albany, Georgia. I'm a city kid. I'm from Atlanta. And we got this thing about Atlanta and Albany. And like, what is that? Like, it's mosquitoes. It ain't nothing down there. They got one shopping mall. I'm like, I'm crushed. So I end up going to Albany State University. And I literally, my father loves to tell this story. He drove me down the 3 hours from Atlanta to Albany. And I literally, as an 18-year-old boy, cried all the way down I-75. I did not want to be at Albany State University.
Wow.
But when I tell you, Gerald, that place was and is magical.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I can say this now. I was actually embarrassed that I was going to Albany State just because, you know, my group of friends were going to, you know, Columbia and, you know, Syracuse and, you know, Spelman, and I mean the more name elite, and I was in that group. I thought, like I said, I got into those.
Yeah, you got in.
You know,
got
in. So, but when I say that God has a plan, oh my gosh, God has a plan. I would not trade. You know, I would not go to any other school. Hit Harvard, Yale, Morehouse, Howard. I wouldn't go any other place. Albany State University was where I needed to be. Mm-hmm. And I went there and I learned some of the lessons that I didn't fully learn in high school.
Yeah,
I was challenged there to operate and to apply myself to the same level of excellence, but I was hearing it from a different voice. I think that was what it was for me, hearing it from professors that I, you know, can recall now, Dr. Beulah Rhodes and Dr. Nyota Tucker and Dr. Stephanie Hankerson and my president there, who was a Dr. Portia Holmes Shields, a Howard graduate, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the experience was like nothing I had ever. And again, I'm an HBCU graduate. I mean, excuse me, I come from HBCU parents that are graduates, but I don't think I even fully got what the HBCU experience really was until I came to Albany State, and it totally transformed my entire life.
So, you know, I'm almost call you Mr. President right now because I want you to put on your presidential hat. And I listened to your story just now, and quite frankly, knowing you now over these years, I can see a common thread. Mm-hmm. And you can tell me if I'm right or wrong. You have been elevated to a position that most people will be 20, 30 years your senior.
Right.
Before they get to this position.
Right.
When you mentioned that God has a plan, the end around that you took, the hurdles you had to jump,
yeah,
and everything that you had to do to be where you are today, how do you translate that to your students and those who are in high school now coming up in terms of those that we would say, hey, you know, this kid right here is not doing it. How do you juxtapose those two to still inspire young people today as a president?
Yeah, I say to my students what my father often says to me. He says, son, you are where you're supposed to be.
Mm.
You are where you're supposed to be. I think so many times we, you know, get caught up in what we see others have and what we see others doing, that we don't rest in the space and in the places where God has planted us. Mm. And so, you know, as I think about kind of, you know, my journey, even from college to becoming a college president, I had no, and I know this sounds cliche and people say this all the time, but actually I think people being a little bit more forthright about it now, but I genuinely had no plans to ever be a college or university president.
Really?
None. Zero.
Wow.
As you know, I'm a lawyer.
But I saw it in you in 2015.
Well,
you
know, I'll tell you, I'm a lawyer by trade. And so even after I finished Albany State, I went to law school. I went to the University of Georgia School of Law, went to law school, did well in law school, was on moot court and graduated from law school, passed the bar exam, and I'm working as an attorney. I had no, you know, in college, even though my, you know, my experience at ASU was phenomenal. I mean, just, you know, the relationships, the growth that I experienced, what was invested in me. I know I wouldn't have gotten any other place. And I had a trajectory towards being a lawyer. I became a lawyer, was working as an attorney, had gone back to DC post a law school and gotten a job right outside of DC in Clinton, Maryland, at a music publishing firm called Van McCoy Inc., where I was doing mechanical licenses, synchronizations. You ever heard the song "The Hustle" was written by Van McCoy? So it was one of the only black owned music publishing companies. That's what I was doing. I had no visions of higher ed whatsoever. Wow. So this is 27 years old. I'm in DC, finished law school. Hey, I'm going to do this lawyer thing. And the story goes that as a former presidential scholar, the presidency at Albany State had shifted. So the president that I matriculated under was Dr. Portia Holmes Shields. She had been there from 96 to 2005. Anyone that knows Dr. Shields or had an opportunity to meet any of her students, there is a bond that she created with her students that is none other. You would appreciate it. It's very much like Dr. Yancey.
Yeah. Yancey, I mean, kids.
Yes. Yeah, we're Shields kids. I mean, you can... Any of her presidential scholars, any of her students, she is known as Madam President. We call her Madam. I mean, she, a bond that I've yet to see very few, if any other presidents have with their students in particular. Mm-hmm. And so I was, again, so this is 06, 07. I'm being very critical of the new administration because I'm an alum now, and I sent a letter to the then sitting vice president for institutional advancement, decrying the fact that they were not doing a good job in terms of their outreach, particularly with young alumni and young alumni who were presidential scholars. I said, hey, you all have invested all these dollars in us presidential scholars. Many of us now are doctors, lawyers, engineers. You all should be wanting to reach out to us in particular as a group so that we could give back and support the institution. And we hear nothing from you. I said, I get something from the University of Georgia every other week. I hear nothing from Albany State, right? So I'm just, you know, I've sent this long letter about what they're not doing and how they need to do better. And so that vice president for institutional advancement, her name is Angela Getter. She said to me then, she said, well, young man, you've got so much energy, so much to say. You came to Albany State on a full scholarship. You talk about all that Albany State invested in you. Why don't you come and be the director of alumni affairs? Wow. Since you have so much to say about what it is that we ought to be doing to reach out to alumni, particularly young alumni, why don't you come and run alumni affairs at your alma mater since you got so much to say? Was I not expecting that? I want a job to do it. I wasn't volunteering to come back to Albany State. And so when she said that, I actually called Dr. Shields. I said, Dr. Shields, you know, what do you think, you know, about this? She said, well, you know, Albany State is given to you. Maybe you owe just even, hey, you're a lawyer, you got time. That's not going anywhere. You're young, but Albany State might need you right now. Why don't you go? And, you know, there's not a whole lot of people that say they got a 4-year degree. They don't owe anyone anything. Go back and give them a couple years. And I'm like, but I don't want to work at a university. That's not, I don't go to law school. Like, why would I go? But she challenged me to go and accept the job. And so I did it. Wow. I left my job in DC, came back to Albany State, and that's how my career in higher ed started, first as a director for alumni affairs at 27 years old at Albany State University.
So when we met in 2015, you were at...
I was at Virginia Union.
Virginia University. Union, that's yes. right. I remember.
Yep, as VP for Enrollment Management and Student Affairs. And so I'd been at Albany State, was there for a little while, and then actually transitioned to Edward Waters, where I am now. Had no idea that I would have an opportunity to come back and be president. So I'd been at Edward Waters before for 1 year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was at Albany State and then came to Edward Waters for 1 year. I wasn't even here a whole year. I think I was here maybe about 9 or 10 months. And the provost at that time at Edward Waters was named president out at Mississippi Valley State University. So Dr. Donna Oliver was the provost at Edward mm-hmm. Waters. And while I was at Edward Waters during this, you know, 10-month stretch, she was named president at Mississippi Valley. And so she goes to Mississippi Valley and she asked me to come with her. But interestingly enough, I had maybe been in, that I recall, one, maybe two meetings. I mean, I'm just a director. I was working in advancement development. She's the provost. But she saw something in me. Even then, to this day, I don't know. And she's mm-hmm. now on my team as the provost, again, and senior VP at Edward Waters. But she saw something in me as a 27, 28-year-old at that point and said, hey, I want you to come with me to Mississippi Valley. And she hired me as her special assistant for legal and legislative affairs.
Wow.
And so I left Edward Waters. I had just gotten married. I was in my first year married to my wife. And I remember coming home in Jacksonville and saying, hey, babe, you want to go to Itabena, Mississippi? She said, and my wife was raised in Bermuda.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
She said, we go to where? I said, Itabena, Mississippi. And she, it's like, absolutely not. No, but after some convincing and cajoling, not a whole lot. I didn't have to do a whole lot of convincing and cajoling. She's a trooper. We went to Mississippi Valley State University in Itabena, Mississippi. And I had someone there in Dr. Donna Oliver who invested in me. I'm sure I look back on it now and I say, I know folks were mad at you. So she made me her special assistant for legal and legislative affairs. Legislative affairs. I was 28 years old. She eventually promoted me to chief of staff. And then, so I was there 5 years. And before we left, I was VP for institutional advancement and development. And like I said, this is at, you know, I'm 30, 31 by the time we leave there. And I got such invaluable experience to sit on her cabinet. You know, do everything. I was the registered state lobbyist for the institution. You know, just the work that experience I got to have in development as the chief of staff to really get to see globally, you know, everything that came in the president's office and helping her to manage and being kind of holding her ladder. I mean, from everything from athletics to enrollment to academic matters to advancement development kinds of things. And then for her to allow me to be a vice president before she left at 31, 32 years of age, it was an amazing experience.
Isn't it always such that people see things in you before you see it in yourself?
Oh my gosh. And she told me then that you're going to be a president. And I was like, I told her, having been, and I say this to me, you know, I say this to different folks that you know, often was like, how do you get to the presidency? And you know, all these people want to be a president. And I do share with them. I said, my most invaluable experience, I think, was as a chief of staff, because for me, it was the closest thing to me that I think you can get to in terms of at least being able to see what the president does on a day-to-day basis in the absence of an executive VP or something like that. You know, and for me, it let me know that I did not want to be a president. Just because it's such a thankless, and I say this now, such a thankless job. Like, you're always on the go. Yep. You can never please all the folks. This constituency is always mad. You know, like, well, don't they see that we just did this? And I can remember saying to Dr. Oliver, you know, but we're doing this and we're doing that, and, you know, really encouraging her. But that experience let me know I did not want to be a president. But she would say to me, but you're going to be a president.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you, my brother, when we were up at Harvard in that program, I saw it. I've never said this to you, but I saw it. I saw it in your demeanor. I saw it in the questions that you would ask and how you would deliver it. So people see things in us before we see it in ourselves. But I want to switch gears a little bit with the remaining time we have. In your short space of time of being president and CEO at Edward Waters, you have accomplished quite a bit. Stadium, buildings, curriculum, you know, you just got a new coach, and you have all of these changes that are happening, but everything is pivoting and pointing due north. Now, here's the question. All of these stops that you made, and I think you might have answered it, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. Do you now look back and say, all these stops I made, Lawyer, Albany State, Edward Waters, Virginia Union, Mrs., all of those things at such a young age prepared you at still a relatively young age to be president?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, with beyond any shadow of a doubt, you know, I didn't know at the time, I don't think many times none of us know, that all of these steps are preparing you for what God ultimately has for you in terms of your purpose and your destiny. I was having a conversation with a person on my staff just last week, and I was telling her, listen, trust the process. Don't try to get out here and do your own thing. Trust the process. God has a plan and a process for you. And that process may not look like my process. Right. And my process may not look like your process. But I will tell you every single step. So, you know, having had the experience, and I'll try to sum this up quickly. But I have to give credit where credit is due. The new stadium that we see, and you can see it in my background here, it's, you know, our first on-campus stadium. We just opened a completely brand new, newly renovated, multi-million dollar residence facility on our campus, our largest student residence facility on our campus. So both of those projects are, you know, in total about $10 million of new construction or renovated construction on our campus. But much of the credit, my predecessor, former President Glover, he was the one that actually brokered that deal before I came to the institution. But here's the key, and I'm going to tie this to what you said in terms of prior experiences and being prepared to do the things that are necessary when you step into the role of the presidency. So when I got to EWC in July of 2018, that deal had been brokered a whole year before. There was a big announcement about it, that the city of Jacksonville, when I said the deal, the city of Jacksonville, which is a very unique deal, this is public money that they're going to give to this private institution for millions of dollars of new construction on their campus. So former President Glover, because he is I tease him all the time, but he really is a giant in the Jacksonville community and throughout the state of Florida. He was the first African-American sheriff elected in Jacksonville, Duval County. So he was a formidable politician in Jacksonville, Duval County. He was able to leverage his political connections with the mayor to convince the mayor and the city council to invest these dollars into the institution. Mm. And so this was done a little over a year, maybe about a year and a half, almost, maybe a little less than a year and a half before I ever took office.
Wow.
And so when I came in, though, everyone was saying, well, where's the stadium? Like, Mr. President, I'm just getting here. I'm like, I don't know. Like, you know, but we've heard that this is supposed to be happening a year, almost a year and a half before. And there's not a doorknob on the door. They ain't put a shovel in the ground, nothing. Right. And so now that I'm in the seat, you know, the fire is kind of on me to get this project going, because they've done news conference, everything big, that, you know, this stadium and this residence hall and all this, you know, millions of dollars of construction is supposed to happen on the campus. So I said, OK, well, go. Someone get me the agreement. Someone send me the, you know, what's the details of this? And I will say and I don't think it's an indictment on anyone. I think it's, to your point, it is you being in the place where God has for you to be. But it was an extreme advantage that they had a lawyer for a president, because when I was able to get the agreement and the document, what I discovered and I was able to share with our board and others and the public and everyone, that the deal was a reimbursement deal.
Oh, wow.
So the way that it worked was the institution had to put out the money, okay, and then we would be reimbursed. Well, that's the reason why the project had not moved, and it wasn't going to move, because we didn't have the dollars.
Right.
We didn't have that kind of liquidity to, you know, even front, you know, $250,000, $500,000 at a time, right. Even though the city was going to give it back to us within 90 days or what have you. I mean, at that time, we weren't in that kind of financial positionality. And so, again, I think to your point, having had the experience of having been a general counsel at Tuskegee, having, you know, been a special assistant for legal and legislative affairs and being a lawyer, it helped me to be able to ascertain, you know, because, I mean, this is a, you know, document. But as I'm reading through it, I'm like, wait, this is a reimbursement deal. And so I was able to go to my board and say, hey, here's why this project isn't happening. And it's not going to happen, at least not in the foreseeable future, because we don't have the liquidity to do this. So long story short, I was able to develop and forge my own relationships with the mayor and city council. And we were blessed to be able to have the mayor and city council to reintroduce the legislation, which was a risk. I will say I was advised by some folks not to do that because it wasn't the most popular thing to do when they got it approved back in 2017. Again, as you might imagine, you're talking about public funds going to this private institution. But we took the risk, and I thank the mayor and our city council to reintroduce the legislation to have them to fund the project directly. And so when we took it back to the mayor supported it. The city council voted 18-0. To reauthorize it and to fund the projects directly. And that's the reason why once that was done, we were able to get the buildings up, new stadium and all. So, you know, certainly, you know, I give credit where credit is due in terms of the vision being there from our predecessor. But it did take, I will say, I have to just be honest, you know, my onboarding and having had that legal training to be able to go in and be able to discern these contracts in a way to see what was going on.
Yeah.
And then my prior experience in legislative work and working in development, you know, it was having the right skill set for what the institution needed, you know, to really, really get things going.
Yeah. Well, Mr. President, I told you, man, we could be here for 2 hours, but let me, I'm going to ask you a question, which probably will be probably our last question, but it is a multifaceted question, and I know it's going to elicit a pretty passionate response from you, but I'm a Howard grad, worked at Johnson C. Smith, worked at Morehouse, worked at United Negro College Fund. So HBCUs are near and dear to my heart. I've asked all of our college presidents, David Thomas, Dorothy Yancey, Beverly Tatum, who have all been on the show. When you look at the HBCU and their history, and you juxtapose that against what you see happening now and a renaissance, so to speak. Morris Brown just got its reaccreditation after 20 years. When you think of that as an HBCU president today in context and time, how can you share with us the importance of the HBCUs, one, and two, if you could leave us with some words of inspiration and encouragement for all that we're seeing happening in our nation and our world today, and as a thought leader in higher education, what would you leave us with to end out this conversation today?
Yeah. You know, I would say, you know, one of the things that really I think is rather sobering for me is some of the work that you have done, Gerald, around the new normal from a financial perspective as you look globally at the continuing posterity for HBCUs that you put out some years ago, which really, I will tell you, my friend, is something I studied and listened to and even still harken back to from time to time. And I will say to you that when I look at HBCUs globally, although we have experienced maybe within the past year some form of renaissance, I see some tremendous challenges still yet on the horizon. And so, you know, I mean, very tremendous challenges for us as a space. But my confidence in Edward Waters and in HBCUs I think, and I just have to be honest, and I don't mean to over-spiritualize the conversation, but I believe, again, my faith grounding, that the work that HBCUs perform are truly God's work. Mm. These institutions, I know I can speak of Edward Waters, I know I can speak of so many institutions, but for the supernatural grace of God, these institutions would not have survived. There's no way you can look at EWC for 155 years and look at what the challenges have been. If you were to look at it, you'd say there's no way that there could be an Edward Waters College today.
Wow.
And so my faith, when I look at, and I think that that's not a story that's unique to EWC. I think that's a story that resonates with the overwhelming majority of HBCUs that are still operating and doing the great work that they do today. So my faith and my inspiration is found in knowing that these are God-ordained spaces and places, and that God will continue despite the projections, despite everything else that says that we have a challenging future, which I see it and we do. I believe that God will continue to provide because of the tremendous work that HBCUs have done and that they continue to do. And I think that if anything that I'm really encouraged and inspired by is that I think that the work that HBCUs are positioned to do now, and I want to say this the right way, but is even perhaps even more impactful than the work that was being done by HBCUs as a whole 40, 50, 60 years ago. And I'll tell you real quickly why I say that. Because as we know, you know, when my parents were looking at you know, accessing a college or university, HBCUs were their pretty much their only options.
Yeah.
As we know now, that's not the case. And so what we're seeing now is you're seeing more upwardly mobile African Americans and Blacks that are choosing non-HBCUs.
Right.
And so the population of students, and you talk about this in your new normal in terms of whether we have the students, you know, from an economic perspective that can pay, particularly at private institutions.
Yep.
But now we're seeing a higher proportion of students that are first generation, that do not come from means of wealth, when 50 years ago, that was not as much the case. I mean, you had that. But you also had, you had all of us. You had those that had the college graduates as parents, those that didn't have college graduates as parents. Everyone had to go to the HBCU. That's not the case now. And so I think that, again, when we talk about the work that HBCUs are doing now, particularly ones like Edward Waters, small private institutions that are more access-based from a mission perspective,
right?
We are now serving a demographic of students almost exclusively that but for Edward Waters literally would not have access to higher education.
Wow.
And so to me, that is much more inspiring work. It's much more impactful because you're talking about a large swath of our community that if we don't exist, if there is no Edward Waters for the population of students that won't be able to matriculate at UCF, doesn't mean that they don't have the potential, doesn't mean they don't have the capacity, but they need the kind of nurturing, they need the kind of scaffolding, the kind of structure that an Edward Waters offers. But for that, these students don't have that opportunity. That's what animates me, that's what inspires me, and that's what I think will continue to be something that will keep the uniqueness of the work that we do at HBCUs will keep our institutions thriving. I tell my team, we have to keep our eyes on the ball of what we do. Mm-hmm. We can't be, and I'm not desirous of being what UCF or FSU do. Great. They do great work. I'm happy for them. Wonderful. We've got to keep our eye on the ball with regard to what it is that we do. And that is providing access, opportunity, and not just providing the access and opportunity. We transform and transmogrify these diamonds in the rough. And after 4 years, they now emerge and they can compete with anyone, anywhere, and compete at a very high level. So that for me is what, again, is inspires me. It should inspire everyone that continues to labor and serve in this HBCU space. Because again, I think that we have an opportunity to be even more impactful. Yeah. Others say that our impact is diminishing. And I see that very differently. Because again, I see that we're able to now focus in on a large swath of our population that formerly we may not have even been accessing to that same proportion. So I'm inspired. I'm encouraged. I wouldn't be a president if I didn't say if there are any parents or students that are watching this broadcast. I know that the University of Central Florida is a wonderful institution. But before there was a UCF, I say this, I have to give this shameless plug. Before there was a UCF, before there was an FSU, a University of Florida, before there was a FAMU, before there was a Bethune-Cookman, before there was a Florida Memorial, the first independent institution of higher education in the state of Florida is indeed Edward Waters College. And it's the state of Florida's first HBCU. So we are welcoming students. You can apply now to come be a part of the great work that we're doing here at EWC. But yeah, that's what inspires me. What inspires me.
Well, Dr. Fajan, I'm going to call you Dr. Fajan today. I met you, sir, over 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I've watched you over the 6 years, and you have not only met, but exceeded everything that I could have thought of. And
Wow. Just
the fact that you would join me on this podcast today, we continue to try to get thought leaders on this program. And that's what it's about. It's about inspiring people, sharing your story. And quite frankly, your story is one that I hope that your students there and the grandmas and mothers and fathers that will send me notes and say, you know, your guests really gave me something to think about. Your story you shared here today, I definitely know it's going to touch one or two people. Now, you're going to have a problem. Your problem is going to be convincing your students that you were destined for the NBA.
That's true. They have no, and I can't blame them. Looking at me now, they'd be like, that did not happen. But it's the truth. Yeah. It's the truth.
Well, they see you doing your Peloton thing.
Yeah, right. There you go. Yeah. There you go.
They'll have some of that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our time is closed today, but I hope you got something out of this conversation today with my good friend, Dr. Fajan, the president and CEO of Edward Waters College, a dynamic individual, as you've heard. As I said earlier, an old soul in a young body. You get a sense of his passion, his drive, and that's what it's all about. As Coach Moultrie will say, it's easy, son. Quit making things difficult. Mm-hmm. And you could see here that Dr. Fajan has grabbed that tenet or that ethos, if you will, and is running with it. So until next week, remember, it's easy, son. Your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Until then, take care and be safe. See you next time. Okay.